The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You will hear a conversation between an international student and the accommodation department. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 1 to 3.
Hello, accommodation department. How can I help you?
Do you look after accommodation for international students?
Yes, we look after accommodation for all the students.
Good. I hope you can help me then. I've only just been accepted onto a postgraduate course, and I want to know if there is any accommodation available from this September. I know it's very short notice.
Yes, it is rather late, but I'm sure we'll be able to find you something. First of all, can you give me your name and student number so that I can find you on the system?
Sure. My name is Maria Teresa Gonzalez.
Maria Teresa Gonzalez. How do you spell that?
G-O-N-Z-A-L-E-Z.
Thank you. Got it. And your student number, please?
SHU300715PG.
SHU300715PG. Ah, here you are. Department of Modern Languages.
Yes, that's me.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 4 to 10.
Okay, now there are several options for postgraduate students. Firstly, there is the Trigon. This is a new block near to the station and not far from the main campus. Accommodation is what we call cluster accommodation.
What does that mean?
There's a small group of rooms, usually six, each with its own bathroom clustered around a lounge kitchen area which is shared.
Oh, I see. That sounds good.
They are very popular. The price for these is £99 per week, and we do have some availability left. However, for postgraduate students, there are other options.
And what are they?
There's another apartment block called The Cube, located near the west gate of the campus. Accommodation there is in one or two bedroom self-contained flats.
So, the cube is self-contained. How does that work?
Well, basically, they're just like ordinary apartments. Each apartment has one or two study bedrooms with ensuite bathroom, a lounge and a kitchen.
And what is the price of those?
For the one bedroom, it is £180 per week. And for the two bedroom, it is £110 per week for each person.
And can I choose who I share with?
If you have a friend and you would like to share with them, of course, we can reserve a two-bedroom apartment for you both. Otherwise, you just have to share with whoever else is there. Obviously, it will be another woman.
I will have to think about this. Do I have to make a decision now?
No, but we don't have much accommodation left, so I can't guarantee that there will still be availability if you leave it too long.
Yes, that's fair. I have a friend in the management department who might like to share. I will speak with her and get back to you this afternoon.
Okay, fine. Do let us know as soon as you can.
I will do. Thanks for all your help.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a conversation between a radio presenter and an author. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 11 to 14.
And here with us today, we have Patricia Abedin, author of the best-selling book Beginner's Guide to Self-Publishing and owner of the self-publishing company Make a Book.
Hello.
Hello, Patricia. Now, I know a lot of our listeners are interested in self-publishing their novels, but they don't know where to start. As a successful self-published author, what would you say are some of the pitfalls they'd need to avoid?
I'm glad you asked that, Mark. The thing is that with the ebook revolution that started in the early 2000s, we experienced a shift in the literary market, and suddenly aspiring writers didn't have to rely on agents and traditional publishers anymore to get the opportunity to publish their books. But just because we can publish, does that mean we should? For me, there are four questions that each writer needs to ask themselves before they attempt to join the market. The first question is my book ready? One of the biggest mistakes new writers do is that they get so excited with the prospect of publishing their book that they rush through the process and they don't bother with the technicalities such as thorough editing. And they should, because editing is about 50% of the final product. It's not as glamorous as the process of actually creating the story, but it's just as important. The final product needs to be immaculate. Not just in terms of grammar, but also in terms of plotting, characterization, and even spelling. Secondly, do I understand the market? Unless you're publishing just for your friends and family, you need to have a sound marketing strategy. The beauty of self-publishing is that anyone can do it, but that also means that you're fighting for attention against millions of other titles. Do you know what sets your book apart? Do you understand who your audience is and how you're going to reach them? Do you have a solid presence in social media? In general, do you know how you're going to sell the book to people? The third question, and I hope I don't sound too pragmatic, is, have I worked out how much money I'm willing to spend? This extends beyond the cost of self-publishing itself, obviously. There's the cost of advertising, the cost of proofreading and copy editing, the cost of giving away free copies to reviewers, and let's not forget the cost of a professionally done cover. The truth is that the more you see your book as an investment, the more of a return you're going to get. But either way, you need to know what your available funds are. And the final thing is something most writers overlook, but it's just as important as the other three. Have I started my next project yet? Remember, one book is never going to make you rich, and it's never going to make you famous. If you want to succeed, you need to keep writing and keep publishing as many books as you can. That's how you build an audience and how you get your book to the top of the charts.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 15 to
Thank you, Patricia. So tell us, how did you do it? You started publishing 5 years ago, and now you have your own publishing company. How did you get here so fast?
To be honest with you, the first book I ever published was a flop, and it was because I didn't follow almost any of the rules I just told you. My novel was poorly edited, it had a cheap-looking, self-made cover, and I had no idea how to get people to buy it. For about a year, I checked its dismal sales every month, and I wallowed in self-pity. But then I decided it was time to change and do something. The first thing I did was get a subscription to all the writing magazines I could find out there. I'd read them all from cover to cover and followed the experts' advice as if it was gospel. I wrote almost every single day, and I submitted short stories to every competition I could find out there. I also started a blog, and I set up my own page. Over time, I started building a name for myself and a solid fan base. I didn't want to be associated with my first book, so I decided to publish my next book under a different name. This time, I sought professional help with editing, and I spent months working on it until it was ready. I also sought the advice of friends who worked in marketing and tech-savvy friends who helped me come up with a marketing plan. Since I already had a platform, my website, and my social media pages, it was much easier to reach the people who would be interested in reading my book. And of course, while all of this was happening, I was also in the middle of my next novel, which I planned to have ready for editing by the time the previous one was out. So, yeah, I published my second book about 2 years after my first, and it was a completely different experience. And now, here I am.
Thank you very much, Patricia. I'm sure our listeners have been inspired by your story.
That is the end of
part two. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part three.
You will hear a conversation between a research student, Jeremy, and his supervisor. They are talking about the process of having a research project published in a journal. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
So, you're nearly ready to submit your article to an academic journal, are you?
Yes, I think so. I just wanted to go over all the things I need to do before I submit it. And then I wanted to go over the submission process with you.
Great. So, firstly, you need to write an abstract. Make sure it's short and concise.
Of course. I forgot all about that. And what about keywords?
Yes. A lot of students overlook this part and just jot down whatever comes to mind. But take some time to make a list of keywords that are accurate and relevant.
Okay. Another thing. Could you have a look at my article before I submit it?
Absolutely. Actually, at least two senior staff members should always read through a final draft before submission. Do you mind if I give it to Professor Johnson to have a look at as well?
Not at all. I'd be glad to have the feedback.
Do you know which journal you want to submit to yet?
Not yet. I have a short list of about three that I'm interested in.
Make that decision soon, because you'll need to adjust your article so that it matches the style guide of the journal you are submitting to.
I bet that can take a while.
Yes, but after that, you are just about ready to submit. One more thing. You'll have to sign the copyright form, just confirming that it's your own work. And then you're good to go.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 26 to 30.
Now, the submission process, how does it work exactly?
Well, the first thing is to just send it off. You've got to send in the manuscript before anything else can happen.
Sure. And then should I call to check if they have received it?
No need for that, no. All you have to do is just log on to your email regularly, because you will get a submission confirmation once they have processed the manuscript.
And that will have comments on what they thought of it?
No, no comments yet. That email is just to let you know they have received it. The next stage is what is known as peer review. This is when experts in the field review your manuscript and decide whether to accept it.
Ah, they'll never accept me. I'm only a master's student.
Don't worry about that, Jeremy. It's all done through a double-blind method. That means that whoever reads your manuscript has no idea whether you are a grad student or a Nobel Prize laureate. They'll only be judging your work, not you.
Well, that's good to hear. And then what, once they've made their decision?
Well, there are four possible outcomes. You might get an acceptance, but a first-off acceptance is very, very rare. Don't pin your hopes on it. You could also get a rejection, but these don't happen very often either. I don't think this will be a problem.
What do you think I'll get?
If you're very lucky, you'll get a conditional acceptance. This means that they've accepted the article and it will be published, but you need to tweak a few things first. A sentence here, a heading there, nothing major.
That sounds good.
But to be honest, you will probably end up with a revise and resubmit. This means they are definitely interested, but you will need to rework the paper before it's accepted. The necessary changes will be outlined by the reviewers.
Okay. So I just fix the things that need changing and present it again?
Yes, but include a cover letter that discusses the changes you have made. The same goes for a conditional acceptance, actually. It helps the reviewers see that you've taken their criticism seriously.
That is the end
of
part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part four.
Part four.
You will hear a lecturer giving a talk on managing creativity in business. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Hello, everyone. The topic of today's management lecture is managing creativity in your business. And believe me, this is one of the toughest tasks that any manager has to face. How do you lead and control the staff whose job it is to create new business and product ideas for you? They are the ones full of creativity and imagination, so they need to have a lot of freedom. After all, they are the people who are paid to come up with new ideas. Controlling staff who are at the forefront of innovation will be one of your most challenging tasks. After all, creativity implies freedom of thought and action. Management styles used to be different, especially in manufacturing. In the factory, staff would be told what to do and how to do it, with a watchful eye kept on them. In that setting, standardization was important for efficiency and product quality. Work could be exceptionally boring, and there was no place for individuality. Now, of course, robots have taken over many of the exacting repetitive tasks. Nowadays, we employ far more people to generate business than to manufacture products. It's very competitive out there. Innovation. That's what our modern consumer craves. Successful companies have got the message. We need lots of new ideas. And now we employ bright young minds to come up with them. However, these ideas have to be implemented to make a change to our profits. So we have to find staff with entrepreneurial flair and be ready to listen to them and support them to follow through on their ideas. We need to supervise without stemming the flow of ideas or sending the brightest minds to work for the opposition. Creative people won't welcome us always looking over their shoulder and checking up on what they are doing. One of the most common ways that management handles this problem of keeping people working along company lines is by establishing achievement targets, like money earned, products developed, or clients gained. These targets are a useful guideline, but they have a downside. Young, enthusiastic staff will be very keen to meet these targets, and some of them might potentially use illegal means or behave unethically in order to meet requirements. For example, by offering bribes to gain sales, or making their sales numbers or earnings look higher than they are, or even threatening or criticizing other staff to get a job completed. Achievement targets are often linked directly to performance bonuses, and this can make a bad situation worse. So as you can see, the standard management techniques can create inherent problems both for the individual and for the company. More recent theorists suggest new tactics for managers. Robert Simons, writing in the Harvard Business Review, has added some new concepts to the thorny problem of encouraging creativity while maintaining a viable business. He suggests three control levers to assist in getting positive creative contributions from the workforce. Remember, this is the point. We want creativity, wild, vibrant creativity to compete in the marketplace. Yet we must be careful to keep people on track, sticking to our core business and maintaining the company's reputation. The first of his levers is getting the workers actively involved in the central ethos of the business. One of the most common ways to do this is to create a mission statement. But along with that, many businesses have some kind of motto, which summarizes their key idea. For example, the most durable tools in the world. Or perhaps, the customer comes first. Whatever it is, you'll want your bright minds to believe it and act on it. So Robert Simons suggests that it should be developed with staff input, letting them feel like part of the operation. After all, their jobs depend on it. A second lever was once described by Charles Christensen, professor at Harvard Business School, as the power of negative thinking. You can't continually instruct your creative minds on what they should do. They are meant to be inventing, leading, not following. And telling them what to do is counterproductive. But you can tell them what not to do. Which potential products are not related to the company's objectives, or which strategies or behaviors are unacceptable. This is a tactical ploy to maintain the company's integrity, It's absolutely vital to establish boundaries to assist in controlling innovation without suppressing it. The third lever is basically sitting down with your crew to share ideas about the business. As manager, your duty is to stay abreast of the external factors, such as who's competing in your market, how well is the company doing this month, and are you losing or gaining money? Is there some new product seducing your customers? This lever is called interactive control. This means you talk to your innovators and communicate honestly and clearly about your perceptions of what's happening in the market. You encourage them to share their ideas and make plans together for the future.